Hello and welcome to the Scottish Song Guide with the Sorries. I'm Marty.
And I'm Douglas.
And today we're going to talk about Wild Mountain Thyme.
And the trees are sweetly blooming, and the wild mountain thyme grows around the blooming heather. Will you go, my single?
Wild Mountain Thyme is a song that has been recorded by thousands of different artists, from the Corries, of course, through the Byrds, Rod Stewart, Nana Mouskouri, Van Morrison, the Alexander Brothers, Thin Lizzy, Bert Jansch, Marianne Faithfull, Glenn Frey, The Silencers, and just a whole heap of other people. You could name your one. I think Ed Sheeran may have done a version of it as well.
But did Ella Fitzgerald do a version? That's what I want to know, after her great version of Loch Lomond that we talked about last week. And even better still, I know that you've subsequently listened to, I sent you the link to YouTube, Ella Fitzgerald's classic song McPherson is rehearsing.
It's brilliant.
With the classic line, and the bonny, bonny lassies with their kilties on their chassis.
That line was never written by a woman, sorry. So, I think when we're talking about Wild Mountain Thyme, the other thing we should probably start saying is, well, should we just be talking about Wild Mountain Thyme, or should we be talking about something a little bit older? Wonder if you want to tell us something about that, Doug.
Yeah, well, there is lots of controversy over this, but basically, Wild Mountain Thyme, I think, unmistakably has its roots in an old song called The Braes of Balquhither. Balquhither is a place just sort of the northern Trossachs, Rob Roy country, really. His grave's quite close to there. But there was a song written by the poet and songwriter Robert Tannehill in the early 1800s called The Braes of Balquhither. And basically, Wild Mountain Thyme shares an awful lot of the lyrics. It's got about six or seven verses, and Wild Mountain Thyme uses kind of three and a half of them, basically. So it was first published in 1807 in Robert Tannehill's collection, A Soldier's Return. Tannehill was an interesting, but as is so often the case in Scottish music, a bit of a tragic figure. He was born in 1774, so our close contemporary of Hogg and Scott and Lady Nairn, they were all about at that time, all sort of born within about 8 years of one another. And of course, when Tannehill was born in 1774, Burns was only 15, and Burns was a big influence on Tannehill. He was born in Paisley, which was a great weaving centre, and his father was a silk gauze weaver. So Tannehill had about 8 years of education and then was apprenticed as a weaver to his father. And he lived in Paisley his whole life, except for a two-year period where he went down to that other weaving hotspot of Bolton in Lancashire. And when he came back to Scotland, he came back when he was sort of in his late 20s, when his father fell ill, he came back to look after his mum. And he came back and started publishing poems in periodicals, things like the Scots magazine and so on. And it was then that he started writing songs. As I say, Burns was a big inspiration, though. He actually co-founded the Paisley Burns Club and wrote a few...
Well, mind you, there aren't that many examples of writers that came out of the working classes and were able to make some decent cash out of their writing.
Yeah.
And I know Hogg was trying to do the same thing at the same time, obviously.
Yeah, well, I mean... And Tannehill never, you know, he didn't make enough to give up the weaving. You know, he continued as a weaver until his death. But he was, as I say, he was in Paisley, which sort of west of Glasgow, really near where Glasgow Airport is now, actually. But this was a great weaving centre. I think at the start of the 1800s, there were about 12,000 looms in Paisley, actually. So, you know, and it wasn't that big a town, but the place where the famous Paisley pattern, you've probably got a few of those ties, Marty, I would think.
Actually, yeah,
yeah, so that is where Tannehill was. He suffered from ill health kind of from the get-go. He was never physically that robust. I think some of the biographies mention him. Actually, one of them mentioned that he had a sort of misshapen foot, which he worked when he was younger to try and straighten. But I think he had problems with consumption and so on. Basically, his biography is a bit like reading Angela's Ashes, I think.
Except a little cheerier, presumably. And also, you're looking at, he's got, you know, so he's got elements of Walter Scott and Robert Burns then. Well, consumption and the gammy leg.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, Tannehill's face is one of the faces on the Scott Monument. You know, there are the sort of carvings of... I think it's 16 other poets and songwriters, and Tannehill's one of them.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. But, I mean, his life wasn't that much less tragic, actually, or that much less gloomy, because he suffered sort of physically. He obviously had sort of mental health problems as well, and eventually he committed suicide. He drowned himself, actually. I mean... Of course, now, looking at it, we can't say that one was directly responsible for the other, but he had published his first collection, the one featuring the Braes Balquhithir, in 1807, and he had done that through subscription. But he thought that subscription, which, I mean, was the common... If you look back at the old song books from around that time and the sort of late 18th, early 19th century, they're almost all have a list of subscribers in the front. You know, that's all people that are paying for it. But when Tannehill had done this for his first collection, The Soldier's Return, he then decided that it was a really degrading thing to have subscribers. So he sent his work off to publishers in Edinburgh and I think Greenock. And when his collection was sort of rebuffed, apparently he burned all his manuscripts. And it was kind of shortly thereafter, that he killed himself.
It's reminiscent of Robert Louis Stevenson when he read his wife the first draft of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and she said, oh, you've missed the main model, so he just chucked it in the fire.
Well, Tannehill's stuff, luckily, some of his friends had copies and so on, so a lot of his stuff was then published afterwards. But kind of, he wrote poems in English and his songs tended to be in Scots, but his poems aren't that well regarded, but it's his songs that really kind of last or have lasted. Although, you know, I say they've lasted, but he's not that well known now.
Yeah. Nowadays, most people are more familiar with the Tannehill Weavers.
Yeah.
And actually, probably quite a lot of people don't even know why they're called the Tannehill Weavers.
Yeah, that's right. So that song, though, The Braes Balquhithir, came from the pen of Robert Tannehill. Yeah, in the early 19th
century. So did he specify the Braes of Balquhithir, Balquhidder, Balhidder?
Yeah, because...
there's a host of different pronunciations.
Balquhithir is spelled as if it would be Balquhidder, and indeed there are versions of it sung where it's pronounced, as you say, Balquhidder, Balquhithir. And a lot of the times it was reprinted, it was slightly different, you know, obviously... People hearing it and going, oh, that must be how it's written. So.
Build my love a bower near yon pure crystal fountain. Eyeing on it, I will show.
Marty, you mentioned that talking about Wild Mountain Time, we have to look back. But where or how did that song, The Braes of Balquhithir, then become Wild Mountain Time, or Will You Go, Lassie Go, or Purple Heather, or Blooming Heather, or whatever it's called. It's had many titles.
Well, it's an interesting one and somewhat sensitive, I think. So Francis McPake is supposed to have written Wild Mountain Time sometime between 1948 and 1950. And there's a brilliant recording of his grandson. The McPake family are kind of a dynasty. There's actually a Francis McPake V, now, but I think he's just a teenager at the moment. But
wee Frankie. But,
you know, presumably, well, he's presumably still big enough to come over and laugh at me for saying that his great-great-granddad didn't write it. Anyway, but so the McPake dynasty have claimed that this is definitely his song. there's a 1995 recording, in fairness, it's an Irish fest in Milwaukee, where Francis McPake III says, some people have said this is a Scottish song. This is not a Scottish song. This is an Irish song. My granddad, he said, wrote it at number 5, Springview Street, Belfast. So he's pretty adamant. Yeah. This is definitely where it was written, which is fine. And I think that's a fair enough comment. But as you've said earlier, we'll go into a little bit more where the lyrics and the tune are from. But his grandfather, McPake III's grandfather, also Francis McPake, was recorded singing it by a folklorist in 1952. There's a recording, it's online. Anyone can have a listen to it at the peterkennedyarchive.org, or you can find it at the British Library. And he says, when Francis McPake is asked, when he plays it and sings it, The Wild Mountain Time, or at least he misses out the first verse. And someone, the interviewer then says, it's a Scots one, isn't it? And he says, well, I don't know whether it's a Scots one or not. It may, of course, be the planter type, you see, something in that nature, or something in the nature of that, he says, which is fine. Now, of course, he's talking to a folklorist, so he's telling him what he wants to hear, that it's a really, really old song. Because Francis McPake said that he got it from the singing of an old uncle who was from Dungannon and was a cattle dealer in County Monaghan.
Right.
He said that he hadn't the last verse. So he says that he wrote the last verse, yeah, basically. So he's not claiming the whole song himself, but then he's talking to a folklore researcher. So he knows that the person he's talking to wants it to be a really old song.
Yeah.
And the cat among the pigeons part is that if he's right, and it is a planter type thing, he's talking about the plantations where the people from Scotland and England basically were settled over the top of the population. That would make it a 16th or 17th century song.
Well, there is a note, Marty, where Tannehill's works were republished with notes in 1874 by a guy called David Semple. I think the title The Poems and Songs of Robert Tannehill. And in that, Semple has a little note saying that the domestic that looked after him in his infant days, as he said, she was from Balquhidder, and she claimed that she used to sing this. She remembers singing it as a youngster. If that were true, if that woman had been singing it way back then, that would suggest that there was a song from perhaps the 1740s.
Yeah. Well, does the tune give away anything like that? I mean, what are we talking here?
This is where it becomes even more interesting or even more complicated, because we know that Tannehill wrote his song in 1807, or it was published in 1807. In that, his note is, to the heir, the three carls of Buchanan. So he has written it to a tune, a pre-existing tune, the three carls of Buchanan. Now,
which was common practice at the time.
Yeah, yeah, of course, it happened with lots of things. But there was a tune which was published. Actually, it's in a manuscript, I think, in 1740, but the first publication that I've seen it in was 1757, and this is a tune called The Braes of Balquhidder. Now, Robert Tannehill doesn't write air, The Braes of Balquhidder. He very definitely, when he writes the song, he gives it a different air. And actually, that tune, as published in 1757, it's in Robert Bremner's A Collection of Scots Reels. That tune is quite different from the one that is then published with the words.
Okay.
Just after Tannehill's death.
Okay, so that tune, the Braes of Balquhidder tune, which is published in the 1750s, is definitely not the one that Robert Tannehill was setting it to.
It is not. Right, okay. So, and just for everyone listening, just to be clear, we are talking about a tune, no words, nothing like that. It's just a tune. But Tannehill said, no, the tune I'm writing these words to, or the tune these words goes with, is The Three Carls of Buchanan. And after Tannehill's death, it appears, 1821, the Scottish Minstrelsy, Volume 1, by R.A. Smith, who was a friend of Tannehill's. He did a lot of the settings. There was Smith and I think John Ross from Aberdeen, they were the two main musicians that Tannehill worked with, and they kind of encouraged him to focus on the songwriting rather than his poetry. But Smith publishes The Scottish Minstrel, Volume 1, in 1821, and he has in that the Braes of Balquhidder, and he has a tune which is completely different to the previously published tune, The Braes of Balquhidder.
Yeah, okay.
But has definite echoes of the current Wild Mountain Time tune.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact, if I just play a little bit, it's obviously not exact, but if I just pull over the mandolin, so... So it's kind of in the vicinity of the tune that we know, or parts of it.
It is. It's not identical though. That's actually the tune that that is in a sort of 1916 recording, something like that,
by
an American soprano, which was one of the first kind of big name recordings of it. Apparently,
yeah.
And you can find it.
But is that under the title The Braes of Balquhidder? I take it.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's the tune that she sings. So that's the one that becomes kind of conventionally known, clearly.
Yeah. Confusingly, 2 years after that tune is published, Smith publishes in his fourth volume of The Scottish Minstrel a different setting to it. But he says that the tune is The Three Carls of Buchanan. But frustratingly, I can't find The Three Carls of Buchanan anywhere. All my searches for it came up with other people going, can anybody find The Three Carls of Buchanan anywhere before 1821? It's like, it's impossible to find. So if anybody does have it out there, then please let us know.
Oh, that's a very niche public appeal, that.
The mountain, where you go, lassie? And we'll all go together.
So the tune then is kind of complicated, and I think you could argue quite a lot over whether the tune that we know as Wild Mountain Time and the tune that you just played a wee bit of on the mandolin are really closely related or related, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Basically, I think it's certainly not, it's not an absolute slam dunk, oh yeah, that's the original tune, but you can certainly see how you could argue that that is an inspiration, at least, for the current Wild Mountain Time.
I mean, the other thing I was just going to say, the other thing is that it's quite heavily based. I mean, the modern tune for Wild Mountain Time is basically just the pentatonic scale, which, for those of you that don't know about it, the pentatonic scale is a five-note scale. So rather than doing the major scale of... you just play... and those notes, I think because they feel natural to play, I'm on the mandolin here, but they feel natural to play on the violin, on the fiddle as well. You know, they really suggest Scottish music and Scottish tunes. So Wild Mountain Time basically just uses, it does put in one note that's not including those five, but the tune is very sort of, is very simple in that way. That's the one that's not there. Okay, so it's there are very few notes in it.
Is that because if we're going to say, okay, so this is Francis McPake. Francis McPake and the whole family actually were noted Uilleann pipers. So it's thought, and also Francis McPake, the first, if you want to call him that, was also noted or supposed to be remarkable in that he was apparently the first guy that could actually sing and play the pipes at the same time.
All right.
So if he was writing on the Uilleann pipes, I don't know whether the Uilleann pipes are pentatonic, if that's kind of what you get.
Yeah, do you know what, I'm not sure. I didn't think so. I assumed that they would be a bit more like the Highland bagpipe scale, but I wouldn't know. I mean, regardless, the pentatonic scale has been used a lot in obviously Scottish music and Irish music, you know. Fiddle music, so, and you know, it sounds great. There's still, you know, countless tunes which basically use those five notes.
It's also would also explain why Mark Knopfler did a version of Wild Mountain Time.
Well, actually, Local Hero uses the tune for that. I'm pretty sure that's pentatonic.
Yeah, that's more or less it, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's pretty heavily based on the pentatonic.
He loves a pentatonic, does Mark Knopfler.
Yeah, much like yourself. Oh, no, that's a gin and tonic, yeah.
Don't knock it. Super wild mountain time, all around the blue. Will you go by sea? So if you look at Tannehill's song, you have the line, "Let us go, lassie, go, to the braes of Balwhither, where the blaeberries grow, mang the bonny Highland heather." And then you have later on, "I will twine thee a bower by the clear siller fountain, and I'll cover it o'er with the flowers of the mountain." And in the McPake family version of it, you have, "I will build my love a tower by yon clear crystal fountain, and on it I will pile all the flowers of the mountain. Will you go, lassie, go?" Now, it seems to me that there's a clear relationship between those two verses, but it's the kind of relationship that you could quite easily get in an orally transmitted song.
Yeah, yeah.
Bower becoming tower is completely fair. Clear crystal fountain coming out of a clear siller fountain.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an entirely obvious shift. And I think also, if you look at the very first verse, "The summertime is coming and the trees are sweetly blooming, and the wild mountain time all around the blooming heather, will you go, lassie, go?" The interesting thing I think about that is that they've shifted the time period, because in Tannehill's song, he has a verse that says, "Now the summer is in prime, with the flowers richly blooming, and the wild mountain time are the moorlands perfuming." So the summertime is coming. It's been shifted to kind of late spring,
early
summer, which then all around the blooming heather maybe doesn't make quite so much sense at that point. On the other hand, what I think is really great is that the McPake family version of it is just brilliant, because he gives you a chorus.
Yeah.
Gives you the hook to hang the whole thing on. "And we'll all go together to pull wild mountain time all around the blooming heather. Will you go, lassie, go?" Now, the last two lines of that, "All around the blooming heather, will you go, lassie, go," are clearly reminiscent of Tannehill's.
Yeah.
But it's the "and we'll all go together to pull wild mountain time." It's hook. It's just a hook to hang the entire song on.
But again, it's funny that, because "will you go, lassie, go," and then the idea of "and we'll all go together."
Yeah.
It's like, well, there's only two of you. But funnily enough, particularly after that period of not playing live, you know, the enforced kind of lockdown period.
Yeah.
I've found it really, when we've been singing that, you know, "and we'll all go together," there's been something quite poignant about that togetherness, especially when people sing it along.
I think it's a really good point. And I think what that is precisely the fact that "we'll all go together" invites everyone in the room to sing it.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of idea of kind of community. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I was going to say about that, we talked in a previous episodes of the podcast about the idea of how some of this is like sampling.
Mm.
It's like you lift lines and you kind of generate something new out of it. And I remember that back in the day when I was playing in an acid jazz band, we did a version of Maximum Slack, in case any of you were wondering.
Marty,
well-known band.
You can barely even get your other current band's material anywhere, so I don't think the band from 20 years ago are going to be hitting that.
20 years ago, that's an act of kindness. Anyway, but I remember we did a version of "You Only Live Twice," the Bond theme tune, with that kind of little line in it. And then, but 6 months later, Robbie Williams put out "Millennium," and I was kind of champing at the bit a little bit. Someone of my friends and say, "Oh, you know, such a shame we didn't do a bit more with 'You Only Live Twice,' because you know that, look how amazingly successful that is." You know, we were playing the same kind of tune, and then one of my bandmates said, "Yeah, but we didn't do that with it." And I sort of feel slightly the same way about "The Braes of Balwhidder" and "Wild Mountain Time." Whoever did it, you know, whether it's just been translated over the course of a number of years or whether it's actually Francis McPake. And I think he must have had a huge hand in it, actually.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
somebody at some point sorted the song out, reworked it extensively, and made it the song that everybody knows and loves to sing. The Praise About Whitter is a great song, but it's not the song that Wild Mountain Time is.
Yeah.
Being able to do that, the skill to do that, is extraordinary, actually. And just to be able to just pull the lines out that need to be pulled out and get the hook, find the thing that will just actually make the whole thing hold together as a shorter, tighter song, is an enormous skill.
I hope, Marty, that any of the McPeak family that happen to be listening have kept listening to the end, where we've been giving him great due, and not just the first 10 minutes where he went, "What, liar, plagiarist?" I mean, there have been, though. It's been the subject of, or was almost the subject of, a legal battle, I think, because I can't remember, was it the Irish Tourist Board or something used it in a commercial, uh-huh. And then the McPeaks were like, "Oh, not this a copyright song, we're going to sue." And then there was a bit of discussion and debate in the media about it.
Yeah.
And then it was just dropped, the court case. But
well, allegedly, Rod Stewart had to recall thousands of CDs because his version of it didn't credit Francis McPeak.
Yeah, that's right.
And but then, you know, a lot of people, I mean, a lot of the credits now you see this tune, people are hedging their bets. They now sort of say Francis McPeak and Robert Tannehill.
Yeah.
And they're crediting the writer of this. Which I think is probably about right, actually.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
My favourite quote about Wild Mountain Time, and actually the one that I think is probably sums up the matter as far as I'm concerned, is an American folklorist called Kenneth S. Goldstein. He said, "A beautiful song knows no national boundaries, as witness this hauntingly lovely Irish variant of an 18th century Scottish ballad," which I think more or less sums it up beautifully. We've talked a lot around it, and we could have just said that and signed off.
Well, it wouldn't be like us, though. On your own. And we love.
If you've enjoyed this podcast and indeed any of the others and you fancy supporting us, then we have a Patreon site where you can sign up and give us a little bit of cash and get some extra goodies, and you can select which level you want to do that at. The thing is that, unlike Robert Tannehill, I quite like the idea of having subscribers.
Yes, I don't find it degrading whatsoever.
Nope.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
See you soon.
Will you go by single? Will you go by single?
Lovely singing, well done.